Deepfakes mean KYC screwed.
That's good. I'm already pretty bought in.
That is not the sophisticated tools you can buy on the dark web for $100. Klarna ripped out Salesforce. Is this the end of software as a service?
Well, cool. So I think those are three interesting things, but let's talk a little bit about what we're hoping to do here.
Yeah, sure. Like, let's talk about three interesting things and get into them. So I'm Simon. I'm head of strategy at Sardine by day, but newsletter fintechbrainfood.com is my passion by night. And I figure, like, why not just get in a conversation with you? And there's always so much happening in the industry. And let's just have a live chat, try a YouTube native format and see if this resonates. See if the things that are happening real time in the industry make sense just off the top of our heads.
Yeah, and I think roughly weekly cadence is what we're going to do. But this is an experiment. So if there are, you know, different things you want to hear, you know, maybe we'll change the cadence. Maybe we'll bring in guests sometimes. We'll see. But it should be a lot of fun. There's a lot happening despite some of the pessimism around certain stuff in the ecosystem.
We both have like a very interesting visibility into the market. And people ask us a lot of questions, so this is a really great way to scale that. But also, it's a great way for you to scale your questions to us. Like, get in touch, drop a comment, like, get involved. Like, how can we change this? Love feedback. Feedback junkies.
Yeah, Simon is hoping if he does this, he has to spend less time doing email, because he'll answer all the questions correctly.
Life is about, one day I will hit inbox zero.
Okay, cool. So let's kick off with number one, and this is a great one for you to talk to specifically. So deepfakes means KYC is screwed. What happened? What made you talk about that, post about it? Is that true? Is that not true?
It's not true. So everybody I speak to in fraud and AML and onboarding is saying, yeah, the volume of deepfakes we're seeing at onboarding is spiking. And humans can't tell the difference. So this came from me spotting a little app that is called Facecam AI. And it was built in 10 days by a college student. And he's like being, you know, Elon Musk and other celebrities. Yeah. But this is something he did in 10 days by himself as a college student. That is not the sophisticated tools you can buy on the dark web for $100 that the companies are really dealing with. And so why does that mean digital KYC is screwed? Well, traditional digital KYC that used to just look at like, I'm throwing phones around. That used to look at the face and the selfie and does it match? And then maybe even just do like a little liveness test. This is all getting beaten on a regular basis. So there's like a whole bunch of other data signals.
Yeah, and
I don't know
if that's quite traditional. Like traditional is you walk into a branch, you give them a physical license. And then, like, they look at it. And then it was like, okay, let's digitize that process. Oh, this is kind of cool. It's pretty frictionless. You, like, hold up your camera. Now, for a while, that's worked. But now it seems like that modality is not as secure or as effective as it used to be.
Well, and then in the pandemic, every bank launched that, right? And the problem is that it's not that, like, KYC vendors are bad and providers are bad. Like, they've been doing a lot of work to get better at this, and probably their latest version of their latest software could do a really good job of detecting a lot of this. The problem is that the financial institutions aren't updating how they do it on a regular basis. 9 out of 10 in the UK, at least, don't actually have liveness detection at all, so you don't even have to do the face moving, unlike in fintech companies. So it's just not evolving, and then they're not looking at all of the other third-party data that kind of sits around the onboarding that can, yes, increase your conversion onboarding, but it's you've got to be evolving, because if you're not evolving, you're dying, especially with the speed this stuff's moving at.
Yep, totally. And I think, people don't appreciate how good the malevolent state of the art is, and also how unadvanced some of the existing practices are. One of my litmus tests for sophistication is just like the password rules for login. And when you log into a financial website and they have these like terrible rules that are very outdated, and I'm using a very long random password and it doesn't go through, nothing makes me more frustrated, let alone, Byzantine processes around KYC. But also, let's be clear, you have a little bit of a dog in this fight in that you work at Sardine, and so you're also, to some extent, saying you can't just do these digital things. You need products like what Sardine is building. Yeah.
everybody's talking their book at some point, right? And I did in that post that's gone down mildly viral by my standards, sort of say, hey, sardine is one answer to this. And the world's going, oh, you're just selling sardine. I'm like, yeah, we're not the only answer by any stretch. Yeah. There's a lot of other things you should be doing, but we're seeing some stuff. We should be having a conversation about it. And like, you don't get the same level of attention if you're not clickbaity. If I'd have said digital KYC is challenged because people don't update enough, I don't think the video would have done quite as well on social, nor would we have generated as many leads from it, nor would we be having this conversation now. So, you know, you sometimes clickbait works, ragebait is overpowered. It's frustrating, but then you get to come on conversations like this and like do nuance and everything. It's fun.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I'll say one thing that's great as the fintech ecosystem is scaled, the ability for people to collaborate, because at the end of the day, no one wants fraudsters to be successful. So like Plaid has a new fraud consortium they announced. I think Sardine might have your own.
We've got Sonar,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also like Plaid is a big partner for Sardine. We take a lot of their data in and we buy it in. And so there's a lot of that goes on too. There's a lot of like closed door dinners, Chatham House conversations where your competitors, there's a bunch of stuff that's non-competitive. Like ultimately we're all trying to catch the bad guys here. So there's a lot of that goes on and people don't realize. Alloy, we should shout those guys out. Persona, iProve, like all those guys.
Yeah, I appreciate all the work everyone's doing there. So if I had to summarize the kind of like so what here, it's basically deepfakes are a problem, but you need, you know, a multi-factor solution. You also just need collaboration among the community. Do you feel like maybe some other things?
And you need to iterate and be iterating your onboarding processes faster because you can't be like making a change, you know, every 2 years and only looking at conversion optimization. Like, well, like there are new attacks coming in and those new attacks you might just not be looking at whatsoever. And that just builds up a problem down the line. So increase the iteration of your controls, because that's going to really help you.
Yep.
All right. I want to dive into the second one here. Right. Just diving right in. Is the FDIC's new rule killing embedded finance? Because seems like it is to me, but do you have a take?
Yeah. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts here. Regulation is frustrating. So is it killing embedded finance? No. If you look at the ecosystem, it's still growing. There's still lots of providers doing interesting work. Is it a challenge to embedded finance? Absolutely. Is it the appropriate regulatory response solving the problem they think they're solving? I think there the answer is no. I'll defer to some folks who know more about it. So let's just talk about each of those three pieces. So one, I think it's pretty easy. Like, yes, there are embedded fintech companies. I've invested in some. There are many others who are doing well. Two, is it challenging? Yes, it is challenging. What is the rule specifically? Specifically, the rule treats broker deposits differently than normal deposits. So let's say you're a bank, you have normal customers and they have checking accounts with you. Those would be, you know, call it normal deposits. This is not using precise regulatory speak. Let's say that that same bank also has a BaaS platform and has a partner who is building a vertical SaaS solutions for nail salon. And those nail salons, you know, have an the vertical SaaS thing has a FBO account with a partner bank, and the nail salons basically have balances at the bank. Those would be, you know, depending on the rule and which one you're looking at, broker deposits. You can also use broker deposits across deposit networks as funding. And what the FDIC is saying is those broker deposits are more flighty. But ironically, and so we had SVB and FRB shut down. Has that been a year and a half ago now, I guess?
Oh my God, yeah, it was March 23. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time
ago. Yeah, I know, it's time flies. But if you look at the actual data, this is from Adam Shapiro, who's at Clara's group. They're a great group, great individual, especially when I go deep on regulatory stuff. It says, like, look, if you actually look what happened in terms of which deposits were flighty, broker deposits were sticky. So there's a case to be made that the rule is penalizing embedded fintech for the wrong reason. It doesn't actually generate flighty deposits. In some ways, it generates more secure deposits. And this isn't crazy. Like, if you think about it, if you have a nail salon that's run some vertical SaaS platform that like does all of your bookings, your rescheduling, takes in your payments, has a bank account, you think of it as your like software platform, and like you hear about, you know, First Republic something, you don't like pull all of your deposits out of your operating system for your business, because like your business needs that to operate, right? So you can understand intellectually why broker deposits or platform deposits can be stickier than normal deposits, even though they're being penalized. So two is like, it is bad, but I think it's, and this is getting to the third one, bad for the wrong reasons. I'd love to hear your reaction, though, too, Simon. I want to be a little, approach this subject with a little bit of humility, because there are people within the fintech ecosystem who are regulatory experts who spend a lot of time thinking about this sort of stuff, and we'll link to some of their commentary so you can kind of get the next level deep. But it is an interesting conversation for sure that does have some implications for, you know, the partner banking ecosystem.
So I wrote a piece called "What the Hell Is a Brokered Deposit Anyway?" because I'd never heard of them. What even is that? And it goes back to the savings and loans crisis of the 80s, where the idea was you had brokers who could help you get the highest yield. So, you know, like in the days of the 80s, you didn't have like a bank rate where you just go find the highest yield and put your money in, the highest savings checking account, whatever. A broker would go do it for you. But a broker might move that around because it's a broker. They're going to find you the best rate and constantly be moving your money. That sounds flighty. Under the Trump administration in 2020, there was a movement of like what the threshold a bank could hold as brokered deposits, all the way up to 20%, and it was hovering lower than that from previous administrations. But the other thing was a loosening of this thing called the primary purpose exemption, which said if your primary purpose is not to like just offer the best rate and be selling that to brokers, yeah, your primary purpose is something else. Like, I don't know, running a SaaS platform, then, you know, we'll kind of look the other way. Maybe you're offering a savings account. You're doing something else that looks like embedded finance. The move back and the removing of all of that just feels like, well, okay, you're trying to solve SVB, which had deposit flight. You've got this rule from the 80s that solved deposit flight in the 80s. Why don't I just copy and paste that and put that back? And so there is some, like, oh, well, I've got this tool, I can just go use it. There's scar tissue going on here. Yep. But there's also like some genuine intent. There's a bigger thing banks have to deal with called the net stable funding ratio, the NSFR. And that thing says you should have a bunch of stable funding. Great. Well, you should have a bunch of stable funding. Now go do a risk assessment of your funding sources.
Under the FDIC, I believe.
Yes. So NSFR is Basel, so it's global.
It's Basel. Basel. Basel is the other capital regulatory regime.
Yeah, and that's for G-SIFIs, so globally significant financial institutions. Yep. That would not apply to smaller banks. So what the FDIC is trying to do, is my read, is like bring these things together with a thing that they had ready made, because regulation is what happens when something must be done, and something must be done when you see blood in the streets and banks going under and whatever else. So it's kind of reactionary, and it's probably in the right spirit, but with the wrong consequences. And so embedded finance, as to your point, for your nail salon, is my operating system. That platform runs my life. I'm just going to leave my deposits there, and I can't really move them very quickly. Wherever they choose is where they go, and they don't really want to move it, the SaaS platform. So yeah, you kind of trust it. I think it's a different thing, man.
Yeah, and be under an exception. And it is fresh. Like, you got to also sympathize with the regulators, right? Like, it's a hard problem to solve. And so I think, you know, one takeaway from this could be like depressing. You're always solving the topical issue, often in the wrong way. The positive, like the silver lining, I think, for me is, I think 10 years ago, the amount of connectivity between people in Washington and the tech community was very small. Now you do have people like Adam and Clara's group, but also other folks. I have a friend.
FS Vector.
Who have like gone back and worked in the administration, and they actually do understand how technology operates and how this era is working. And so I think there is some cross-pollination in a positive way. And when they do good things, we probably don't hear about it because it's not like, oh my God, what's going on? So there are some people who are doing the work. But then you do have problematic rulemaking.
The problem with being really good in Washington, if you're a policy person for an industry, is you're like a secret agent. When you do your job well, nobody cares. But when it goes wrong, everybody calls you. It's kind of a whole thing. But before we depress ourselves with regulation, I want to talk to you a little bit about Klarna apparently ripping out Salesforce.
And this is our kind of third thing for the day.
Yeah, like this is our this is our third thing, and I want to spend some time on this one because like there's a view that this is the end of Salesforce and SaaS. I saw a picture of Dreamforce where apparently they had a band called Kygo. I think it was Shiel Monarch posted it, and like nobody's there in this arena. Like there's a narrative thing going on here that Klarna's doing.
I was
job.
On my way as well, but I had a sick kid, so I stayed.
but like talk me through what happened here. What's your take?
So CEO of Klarna, which they're an IPO candidate, announced they've been at the forefront of leveraging a lot of OpenAI's capabilities. And they've been doing layoffs. So what they did here specifically is put out a statement that like, hey, using these new tools, we've replaced Salesforce. Why is that a big deal? Well, if AI and AI agents, not that this is necessarily agentic, start to replace core SaaS systems, which everyone thought were incredibly sticky, like Salesforce, what does that mean for the whole SaaS ecosystem? Mm-hmm. It's kind of terrifying, especially for, you know, legacy incumbents who themselves, you know, Salesforce pioneered the SaaS business model as the kind of canonical SaaS company. So it's like a direct attack on that. So that's what happened. I think why it's interesting, I think two things. One, which is obviously true, which is master marketing move by the CEO of a company that's about to go public, that wants to reduce headcount, become more profitable, and be an attractive potential investment for public market investors. He's reducing headcount, and he's getting to spin that in a narrative that we're being incredibly efficient through AI. I don't know why more people aren't doing this and trying to really sell this narrative, because I think it can be an incredibly effective marketing tool. Two, how much substance is there behind it? And this is where I think it's a little bit more nebulous. I do think there is some substance. There's both substance in the sense of what's possible today, but also even if the substance isn't true today, these new models are so capable that it can become increasingly true over time. So you're kind of pre-selling you know, the future state of the art. And that's where, so like, have they ripped out Salesforce? I think you had some commentary on the extent to which they have or they haven't. Also, their utilization of the platform is probably very different as someone who manages hundreds of thousands of small merchant accounts globally versus someone else who might be doing, you know, enterprise sales or have a different motion. So that's my thing. It's like great marketing, pretty interesting conversation around what SaaS stickiness means, but maybe a little bit of pre-sale. I want to hear your thoughts here too.
I'm with you 100%. This is a masterclass in marketing because you've got an efficiency story of look how efficient we're becoming. You've got an AI story as part of your IPO roadshow of like, this is all going to happen. You get the comeback kid because you were the canonical worth $40 billion down to six, took a down round, and now you're going to IPO at possibly 20. So you need this like constant set of headlines. And the first set of headlines was that generative AI is doing the work of, quote, 700 staff. And you can see how that's possible. Like, if you add up the hours, it would have
customer
taken staff
rep,
to...
So they basically halved their... Yeah.
And you can see how that's possible, right? Like, if a chatbot can take it from being 7 minutes to deal with a call to 2 minutes, there's 5 minutes per interaction and how many of those per year or other. And then if you can multiply that however many times. Also, how many customers are you dealing with 24/7 when call centers would have been closed? So that was number one. Number two, what platform were these folks using in the first place? Probably using something a bit like Salesforce as their CRM. So how many seats do you need if you've let 700 people in customer service go in the first place? So the shutting down and exiting comes from an off-the-cuff comment he apparently made in some sort of earnings call. And therefore, you know, the plans to shut down Workday in a few weeks, you know, you've got to question how much were they using Workday in the first place? How many seats did they have for Salesforce? Are they really going to turn it off? And what's actually going on there? The devil's always in the detail and the nuance is always more difficult. But that doesn't mean, to your second point, that AI is invaluable. In fact, quite the opposite. It looks an awful lot like AI agents are extremely valuable, so much so that Salesforce is now talking about Agent Force. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do pull a meta here and rename themselves from Salesforce to Agent Force or something along those lines. Like, you've got to be owning
that
narrative.
I've been following Benioff's tweets on this. He has some good tweets about... My team can find those tweets and put some of those up about how he's trying to promote their agentic offering at Salesforce now.
Like, unpack that for me. What is an agentic offering? Because I keep hearing this term everywhere. Every VC saying agents and agentic, but everybody I talk to in technology is like, define an agent for me. Like, define what that actually is.
I think it's the thing that does the workflows on top of it. So it's like a better version of RPA would be one way I would put it. Like sexier,
yeah, so
sexier, more capable RPA. Robotic process
RPA for complex,
UiPath,
etc. Yeah, RPA for complex non-recurring tasks with problem solving involved that would have historically been left for a human. Like, there's a bunch of like, here's 100 scattered unstructured documents. Figure out this puzzle and do something about it. Push a button, make a decision.
Yeah. And I think when I think about this, like the takeaway for founders or operators listening is, should you rip out Workday and Salesforce from your companies? Probably not. Should you be experimenting with building internal agents and tooling? Yeah, like definitely. And could you get some pretty high leverage out of that? I think so as well. And then I guess the third audience would be like, if you're thinking about starting a company, man, the service area of the things you used to have to build maybe is smaller, and you can bundle more products together because you have new affordances from a new tool. And some of those areas I think are going to be a bloodbath because people are going to coalesce around building the same kind of AI agent. There are a lot of AI financial analysts out there is like one category.
Onboarding for KYB businesses. And it's like, yeah, is this a wedge that allows you to own a platform, or is it a feature of a platform? And every platform, everybody who already owns the workflow could build this, or is that like, the classic innovator's dilemma.
Yeah, and but then there's also the opportunity. Now we're just talking about how AI is an opportunity generally. One opportunity is efficiency and selling tools mostly to incumbents or other folks to optimize, you know, their expense ratio, reduce customer service stuff. I think that's real. Maybe that'll be by third-party vendors. Maybe that'll be built internally. I interviewed OpenAI and Morgan Stanley in 1 year built a tool that's being used by all of their advisors. Similar to Klarna, is that tool amazing? No, but I've never heard of a bank launching a new tool that gets rolled out and built that quickly to as many of their staff. And that's pretty impressive and interesting and worth paying attention to.
I had the good fortune of meeting with some folks over at Klarna. I think it was the CTO some time ago. And they were talking me through some of the partnership they have with OpenAI. And it's pretty deep and it's pretty comprehensive. And it's been going on for a long time. Like, in order to use this stuff well, it's not something where you show up and you use the Microsoft Copilot a little bit because it's embedded inside of Office, right? Like that's one extreme that I think everybody's experienced, and you know, the free version of ChatGPT. And then there's the other extreme, which is you use it in a way that is deep and becomes a capability, and you're pushing the boundaries and you're working with the issues and you're using multiple models. And that's really, really hard, and it's becoming a skill, and that's where the real battleground is.
Yep. And kudos to Sebastian at Klarna, because, you know, he said he got on a plane when he played around with ChatGPT. Now, it's been almost, I can't even keep track of time, a year or 2 years. And he just spent time with Sam Altman, spent time with the OpenAI team, said, I want to be a guinea pig for doing a lot of this stuff. So, like, he's taking it very seriously and being good at marketing, how seriously they're working on it.
But, like, there's lessons there, right? Like, if you are gonna be a CEO of a fintech company these days, how do you position your narrative? How do you upskill the organization? How do you get more efficient when there's a potential platform shift going on? And everybody talks about, is there an AI platform shift? Well, potentially, but maybe not on the consumer side initially. It's more on the SaaS side. Like, that's, we don't know, but it's, you know, there's a lot of people trying. It's just hard to get there.
Yeah. Now, we talk about all the AI stuff. I think financial services still, we got a lot more to unpack there. You want to do one more? We could talk about the Fed rate cut if you want. We've got some time. What that means?
Yeah, let's let's get into that. Before you do, though, are you like a 0.5% or a 50 basis points guy? Like, where do you stand on... Did you see this meme?
I haven't seen that meme. I would say 50 bips, though. So
yeah, see, I think it's like a Rorschach test. So there's this meme that's taken off, which is...
I used to be a banker, so I guess that belies that.
We'll find it. We'll show it on the screen. We'll show you that meme. I'll get it to you. But I'm with you. Like, for anybody that doesn't know, and I'm sure you all do, like 100 basis points is 1%. But it's actually, when you're dealing in like small fractions of a percentage, you start getting the math wrong if you're dealing percents of percents. So like, to avoid that, people talk about basis points, and so 50 basis points would be 0.5% in that. The meme was essentially saying 50 basis points when it's 0.5%, and like, there's somebody, it's like almost like a mic drop, kiss the ring kind of moment, I think speaks to there's this sense of everyone's following macro now. Maybe we all just got older, but macro seems like a meme in a way that people didn't follow rate cuts quite the same way 20, 30 years ago before we were always online. And now it seems like the VC community and the banking community and the tech community and everybody's watching that. Like,
I'd push back a little bit. I think people still followed it 20, 30 years ago. I think it's really the last 10 years or 13 years post GFC, Great Financial Crisis, where we just lived in a steadily rate declining world. And so there, it just wasn't that topical for a long time, and we forgot to think about it. And so, because rates were, you know, in the teens in the 80s, people were very much thinking about rate, and we had stagflation in the 70s. So like, there were periods of time, but now it's kind of back. And that's where that was interesting about the post-COVID era, and the COVID era generally, is like all these things we thought were like permanently behind us, like inflation, global pandemics, potentially World War III. Not that I think, well, I mean, you can look at, that's a different thing, but you know, like all these things, like, oh man, like all these things we thought were like history, they don't go away. So I think that's where we are with the kind of base, but let's talk about what it actually means. I don't want to say like, was that a good decision, a bad decision? I want to more just say like, let's connect why the macro matters for the venture ecosystem. And then I think it matters even more for fintech versus the regular venture ecosystem generally.
I agree.
That you want to start with why it just matters for the exit environment.
I think you're probably better qualified to
I can give you my take too if you want to hear it.
Yeah, I think I feel better on the fintech side because, you know, on the fintech side, it's very clear that most fintech companies have done really well in a higher rate environment, whether you're lending or whether you're taking deposits. There's more money to go around. The banks are getting more, but you're getting some of it. That sweet, sweet deposit juice. It's lovely. Yeah. And you can look at Revolut's results. You can look at Affirm's results. You can look at everybody. But also now everybody's feeling the cycle start to kick in where it's like, cool. Rates were really, really low. So we got this really high yield from deposits and we could lend out at the same old rates. And then you see net interest margin compression. Those two things get closer together as it normalizes and then rates come back down. And that drug you got addicted to of easy money starts to go away as rates come down. So there's like it's not going to be as easy to make money by just holding on to money anymore. But it might also get easier to get the next funding round. And I'm sure you've got perspectives there.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the general venture category, interest rates go down, your discount rate for, you know, discount cash flow for valuation, the denominator goes down, which it makes it more attractive to buy into equities generally versus debt, right? So that just means more money eventually ends up in the venture ecosystem. We've had a dearth of exits. If there's more demand for equity versus debt instruments, we can potentially have a better exit environment. That kind of hits everyone, I think, equally within the venture ecosystem. And this is what you started to talk about. Rates hit fintech in actually a disparate way, and I think in an even more material way. There is that exit consideration around, you know, equity values, but there's also business models in fintech can be pro or counter interest rate cycles. So we've seen a bunch of them are pro rate cycles. If you have idle deposits, if you have lending, you need lending spreads. But conversely, if you're raising debt instruments to fund those, that got a lot more expensive, especially for new entrants. So new entrants really got crowded out. If you're in an area of fintech, like PropTech would be the prime example of this. It's very rate sensitive, like a lot of deal origination, refinancing. If you're trying to build anything in mortgage, consumer residential mortgage, that market is really frozen up. So this is one of the big things about fintech is some areas do well when rates are high. And then people are like, oh, if they go down, that could be really bad. And then some are the opposite. And then ironically, some areas like lending, it could be really good when you're at a certain scale because, like, oh, rates go up, you have more net interest income, but really bad if you're trying to start a new lending company, or not bad, but more difficult because your cost of funding is way higher, especially for something unproven. It's just harder to make an attractive offer. And so you have all these different considerations. And I think actually some of the best lending companies, everyone hates lending companies, but it used to be it was easy-ish to start a lending company because everyone was looking for risk and yield. And one way you could do that is you give a fintech a debt facility to originate credit back in the late teens. And now you're like, whoa, no, like I can just buy treasuries and get great yield. Like why would I like go out on a limb here? But if you were able to build a company that did that in the last 2 years and now rates go down, you get this kind of tailwind to your business and you've got a little bit of scorched earth in terms of competitors coming behind you. So rates matter to venture. They really matter to fintech, but how they hit different sectors is going to be an interesting consideration.
It's really, really varied, isn't it? To your cost of funds point is one thing, but also the valuation. Like we saw with the peer-to-peer lenders that suddenly everybody got really concerned about being considered a lender and having a lending multiple. And so you see this jujitsu where people do not want to be in the Bank Holding Company Act boundary of having to be a bank. And there's like a whole, it's a weird law that says if you do things that look too much like banking, then that's all you can do. Unless you're like Toyota, in which case, of course, you're going to do a bit of auto lending and that sort of stuff. There's like the industrial side that's kind of fine. So the industrial loan charter, the ILCs, take off in embedded finance a little bit. But if I'm like one of the big fintech companies facing consumer, there's a like, do I do consumer lending? Can I call it something else? Is it really earned wage access? Is it? And then that's why the people don't like the Truth in Lending Act and TILA from the CFPB, because you're calling it lending and we don't want to call it lending because that might hurt my multiple in the public markets. And there's a bunch of other reasons as well. It means a bunch of oversight and potentially I have to become a bank. But there's a counter narrative that Alex Immerman and I think it was Jake over at Andreessen said, which is like, maybe being a bank's not a bad idea. Like, maybe more neobanks should become banks. Maybe that's not terrible. If, like, most of what you do is financial services, you can make a lot more money. You can get a lot more efficient if you go down that route. And we've seen, you know, neobanks doing okay. Granted, Brazil is a cheat code. But also, Revolut's heading towards a license. There are these global examples now where it's possible. And the FDIC granted 8 new de novo charters in the past year or so in 2024. Like,
that's kind of the counter narrative. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe there's a counter narrative coming, which could be interesting.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I'm excited for more fintech companies to go public is in part they are playing around with new business models, new regulatory setups for the companies. And nothing is as good as the public markets in terms of just providing visibility and awareness as to what is and isn't working. And then the rest of the ecosystem can learn from that. Of course, if you're really innovating, you're probably going to have to like discover some painful truths about the new thing you're trying on your own because it's not going to map one-to-one, but it can still be very informative. It's like, should I get a charter? Has anyone done that successfully? If so, what does that look like?
Oh, yeah, so SoFi. Is one example. It's one of those where like a lot of people who've been watching the banking industry for a few years are like, when's Gravity going to catch these guys? They don't have a banking multiple, but they're also not a bank in a lot of ways. Like they've got this really interesting model where it's like this chimera thing of like lots of different businesses wrapped up under with a charter. And actually I think that maybe
you sound like me. People are like, what do you think of SoFi? And I think it's just hard for me to digest because they have a bunch of things and they keep acquiring new things. And so you don't have stable visibility into the growth of the core
and it feels like their deposits are growing the you know, like at a real clip, but then also they're offering high yield, so of course the deposits are growing at a real clip, and their membership is growing, and then they offer the student loans, but that also means that they've got high FICO scores by default. There's something really interesting in what they're doing, but there's also something weird, and I can't quite put my finger on it, and I don't know what it is.
It's because they're trying to bundle a bunch of stuff, but kind of later on. And that's just, it's hard. Like, it's been hard for banks to do that. I think it's hard even for, you know, the first generation of very interesting fintech companies to do it. I will say one thing I'm excited about is I think the next generation of companies, if you start building these bundles early on, I think you can actually do a pretty good job of it. And one that's like a cohesive narrative. So, like, if you're a vertical SaaS platform for nail salons, this is the example that always gets used, but it could be any other category of business. It makes sense that you would do like payment processing, deposit accounts, eventually lending, and you can tell a very clear story about what that looks like. Whereas I think the story is just, it's more muddled with SoFi.
Well, we've seen it with the spend management sort of platforms now, like the Ramps, Brex, Mercuries, They're all sort of converging on how they've rebundled banking and treasuries and treasury management and APAR and kind of corporate cards. And like that bundle is fairly well understood, is a rebundling.
Awesome. Well, we cover a lot of ground today. It's super fun. I think we also went down some rabbit holes. We did the deep fakes thing, KYC, FDIC's new ruling, Klarna and Salesforce. We even touched on the Fed and their recent actions, venture and the fintech ecosystem. I thought this went great. I hope people listening also enjoyed it. Maybe they have some comments on things we could do better, differently, or just things they're excited to hear about.
Yeah, what do you want to hear us talk about? Send us your favorite subject for the week. We kind of come up with this 5 minutes before, and we got a running Google Doc, so you could be on that Google Doc. Like, get in touch, guys, and let us know what you think.
And if we say something that we disagree with, like one of the things I love about the fintech ecosystem is there are so many people who are so much smarter than I am on so many areas. Like, I always feel a little concerned when I start talking about regulatory things because I'm friends with people who are way smarter on this stuff than I am. And so if you're like, Rex, that you sound like an idiot, let us know. Like, we'd love to hear that.
Yeah, no, I'm professionally somebody who sounds like an idiot, but in a British accent, so it goes over a little bit better. It's useful. As I'm happy to be that guy for you, but no, likewise. Like, please. The fastest way to learn is to be wrong on the internet, so tell us why we're wrong. I love learning.
All right. Awesome. Well, super fun. I think great one, and we'll see you guys next week.
Later, guys.